I'm going to make him an offer again with you.
What are you worried about? It wasn't your head.
White Aryan Resistance Radio calling. White Aryan Resistance Radio calling. This is Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger, in the bunker right here in north central Indiana on a beautiful day. Sun shining brightly. It's warm. The birdies are singing. The rabbits are hopping. The cows are mooing. It's wonderful here. We're at P.O. Box 401. Warsaw, Indiana, not to be confused with Warsaw, Poland, 46581. And once you send all your money into that box, go up to resist.com and get educated. So you can be an educated donator. Yeah, it's beautiful out. And the crocus is growing. You know what a crocus is? That's a flower. I'm busy planting forget-me-nots down by my creek because I'm told they spread really fast. A friend of mine lives on the side of a lake, and a few years ago they planted forget-me-nots on the bank, and now forget-me-nots are all around the lake. So that sounds like a good idea to beautify my little spread here. Well, I think I goofed yesterday. I think I forgot to tell my She-Wolf webmaster to put a show on because I had to go to a doctor's appointment. No, ADL, I'm not dying. Don't get ready to celebrate quite yet. Anyhow, I guess the show didn't go out yesterday, and so a few people emailed me and said, "Hey, what's-a? Come on, man." Sorry, boys and girls. I had to drive 100 miles yesterday, or nearly 100 miles, and have them stick needles in my arm, test my blood. They said, "Hell, you ain't got no blood, you racist bastard. Get on out of here." Yeah. But I can't believe it. They said, "Hey, you all right, man. Your blood pressure's great. Everything's running great. Just continue what you're doing and drink the right kind of booze and you'll be all right." We've got a great VA hospital in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and they really treat you right up there. And, you know, if you dress, and I wear my cowboy hat all the time and everybody wants to salute me. I think they think I'm an officer. Boy, have they got that screwed up. Well, they're hot and heavy about Obama's shoving in a new Supreme Court justice since they bumped off Scalia, trying to make him eat a pillow. And I know Scalia ate a lot, but I don't think even Scalia could get a pillow down his throat. But he was one of the more sane ones on the Supreme Court compared to all those crazy people. He got Jews and he got Clarence Thomas. He never says anything. He just sits there says, I'm not going to say nothing, because if I do, they'll jump down my throat. I know how these white boys and these Jews are. Yeah. Well, anyhow, the funny part about it, I heard earlier this morning in the wee hours that this judge they're trying to shove in there, of course, he's been 19 years in the D.C. area, and he, on one case, he ruled that the private citizens in the District of Columbia didn't have the Second Amendment protection of individually owned firearms. Well, now that opens up a couple of areas we could question him on, because the D.C. area is about, what, 80% black? So the question I have is, did he not want private ownership of weapons to the Negroes? Or did he just didn't believe in guns? You got to ask that question. Get on the talk show and say, how come he didn't want the black people of D.C. to be able to defend themselves? And how come Obama would choose a judge that would deny the Negro the Second Amendment right to have a gun? Now, you should be calling in on these radio talk shows and asking that question. Did he just hate guns? Or did he hate niggers? Or did he hate both? Incidentally, this thing about blocking or stopping the appointment of a Supreme Court judge has happened several times in the last few decades under with a Democrat Senate. Same thing happened. But you hear him squealing all over the place, you know. Those dirty Republicans, of course they are dirty Republicans, but that's beside the point. Do you notice how nobody's really investigating what the meeting was all about down on Jekyll Island last few weeks by the Republicans, supposedly panic-stricken by Donald Trump? I don't hear it on any of the talk shows. I don't hear any of the Democrats or liberals or whatever you want to call them saying, hey, what the hell? And why wasn't there a spy there? And how come the press wasn't there? Is it because this is exactly the way it was planned? That Donald Trump would reactivate all the people who'd fallen away from the Republican Party and get them out to vote, get them registered, fill the ranks of the Republican Party? Was that the game all along? And was that what they were meeting down there in Jekyll Island about to say, huh, it's going pretty well, right? We planned it well. Those stupid idiots, we pulled it over on them again. Yeah, that's the question I'm asking. Who's asking what happened on Jekyll Island? Or wherever it was at down there in the Carolinas, they had that secret meeting. Inquiring minds would like to know. Donald Trump, I guess, had made a statement yesterday about if they tried to screw him at the convention, there'd be riots. Hey, that's going to be great. Riots inside and riots outside. I got to get a ticket to this thing. This could be the beginning of something great. Worse is better. Remember that, boys and girls. Well, it's time for Uncle Tommy, Terrible Tommy, to read the, not the funny papers, but the terrible papers from the past. Of all the bad things that have happened to white people and other people in the past, man. So don't feel bad when it happens to you. This is from the Pessimist Guide to History. 1845, Quebec Fire. On May 28th, the ferocious winds spread a fire from a tannery throughout much of the lower section of Quebec, Canada. About 1,500 buildings were destroyed, and some lives were lost, though no figures are available. Okay. 1845, Chinese theater burns. About 1,670 people were killed when a theater in Canton, China, caught fire in May. Must have been a pretty big theater. 1845, fire ravages New York City. On July 14th, a terrible fire that began at 3 a.m. in New York City lit the early morning sky. Originating on New Street, it spread to a building filled with a large amount of saltpeter used in making gunpowder. See how war helps you out? People throughout the entire city then heard the tremendous roar and exploding of the saltpeter, while the blast set fire to buildings up and down 100 feet away. Fires now raged through the city streets, sending up clouds of smoke, cinders, and sparks. Firefighters doggedly fought the flames and finally managed to contain the blaze at about 1 p.m. In 10 hours since the fire had started, over 1,000 buildings and properties worth $10 million had been destroyed, and an unknown number of persons killed. New York, however, was to have little respite. 5 months later, on December 16th, yet another major fire struck the city. It got people thinking about the need for real good fire departments. I guess God hates New York. Yeah. It didn't strike Warsaw, Indiana. 1846, the Donner Party. Ooh, yummy, yummy. On October 28th, 90 pioneers bound for California found themselves trapped by heavy snow near Truckee Lake, now Donner Lake, in the Sierra Nevada Mountains. Well, they were advised to go a different way, and they chose they wanted to get there faster. Sometimes faster is not the best. And they were city slickers, too. As food supplies dwindled, and the party was forced to slaughter their cattle, horses, and even their dogs for food. On December 16th, a party of 17 set out from the camp to cross the mountains to find help. After several had died of starvation and others resorted to cannibalism, might is right, the 7 survivors staggered into an Indian camp in mid-January and reported the plight of others at Truckee Lake. Meanwhile, the pioneers back at Truckee Lake were reduced to eating boiled rawhide. The bodies of the dead littered the camp because the survivors were too weak to bury them, and probably the ground was too hard to dig a hole. At least one man resorted to eating the frozen bodies. Gee, that must have been tough on his teeth. Only 48 members of the original Donner Party finally reached the safety of Sutter's Fort in California. Well, they're lucky that many made it. 42 had starved to death. This way across the mountains is now called the Donner Pass. Don't take it in the winter. And listen to the tour guides who told you not to go that way in the first place, but you were in a big hurry to make money and find gold, right? Duh. Darwin Award. 1847, Japanese earthquake. A massive earthquake struck the Japanese city of Nagano, located in the northern part of the island of Honshu. About 34,000 people lost their lives. Mother Nature altered the Pacific again. 1848, French February Revolution. For days there had been a tense standoff in the streets of Paris between the angry crowds demanding government reforms and maybe a couple of loaves of bread, and the soldiers loyal to the government of the King Louis Philippe. Then at 9 p.m. on February 23rd, a mysterious explosion occurred outside the Foreign Office. Gee, I wonder what that was. I saw this thing look like a bowling ball going over my head, but I never realized it might have been a bomb. The soldiers, thinking they had been attacked, opened fire on the crowd. And a number of demonstrators were killed or injured, while still others were trampled in the mad rush to flee the gunfire. When the shooting stopped, demonstrators loaded the dead into a cart and paraded about the city, calling for vengeance. Sounds reasonable. That night, street barricades went up throughout the city as the angry demonstration became open revolt. Now we're talking. The next morning, the army was given orders to shoot rebels. But later that day, the Tuileries Palace came under rebel gunfire. And the king decided to surrender. As he delivered his abdication at the Palais Royal, the mob broke in after clambering about in wild rampage, finally drove the royal family and the ministers away. Both the Tuileries and the Palais Royal were sacked the next day, while in the provinces outside Paris, mobs stripped and burned chateaus, demolished bridges and railway stations, and tore up rails from the tracks. Now, I wonder if they just did this out of meanness or not. Usually when people resort to this kind of stuff, it's the final straw that broke the camel's back and we're going to fuck up the ruling class. Following the king's abdication, the short-lived French Second Republic was instituted. Unrest during the early months culminated in a workers' revolt and bloody street rioting during May 1848 before the government finally established order. These French sure do love their revolutions. Well, I'll tell you what, we felt the aftermath of this revolution of 1848 because tens of thousands of people fled Europe and came to the United States, and many of the young men, thousands of the men, were drafted into the Federal Army to go kill white Southerners. A lot of people don't know they ended up killing white Southerners, so a lot of people don't seem to remember that. They didn't remember that. And that's how we got a lot of German Jews into this country, too, because in that revolution of 1848, there were radicals from all over Europe fighting. Yeah. So it wasn't just the French. The Germans and a lot of other people came into that revolution and said, "Is this a private fight or can anyone get in?" Ever notice how the system history always says these horrible rabble rose up and created havoc and hung people, killed people, deposed kings? It's always, they're always cast in the mob. They're bad. That's what the way the system thinks. If they don't have total order and pacification, then anyone who opposes that is bad, and a mob, bad people, don't have any reason to rise up and chop heads off. Why would they want to do that? They're fed so well, they have so much money. Oh boy, I wouldn't bet money that we don't see that kind of stuff in this country sooner or later, with all this menagerie of different religions and politics and races. It'll come. And all this liberalism, which is only skin deep, will be swept away like the wind was sweeping away things in my backyard last night. My trash cans went all over the place. When they come like I've got a split gate going into my backyard. And I put a great big, about 20-pound urn of dirt in front of that gate. And the wind was so wild yesterday, it blew that urn away and opened the gates. That's what rioting is like. Here's something you might be interesting as an antidote or whatever. The local ham radio club is going to have exercises supporting emergency procedures in case of tornadoes and stuff like that. It just happened to jog my memory that I and a couple of other guys way back in the 50s started this club. It's called the Hoosier Lakes Amateur Radio Club. We started it. When I came back here from California, I contacted them and said, I'm back here. I'd like to come to a meeting. They never responded and never invited me to the meeting of the radio club that I helped originate. They didn't like my racial politics. And along with that, I had received the A1 Operators Award from the Amateur Radio Relay League, which is the top organization of ham radio, and almost nobody gets that award. I got it for my activities in radio communications that had to do with the Cold War and also during a strike by Bell Telephone that they needed Ground Observer Corps reports. And the only way we had to do it was ham radio. I ran the damn station. And several other things I had done as an amateur radio operator. I was the Civil Defense Communications Director at 17 years old. Had my own office in the top of the courthouse building, way up high. We had communications. We converted taxi cab transmitters, transceivers, and put them in the back of our cars. Now, you'd think that all of that would afford me at least being invited to the club that I helped create. I mean, this is what bastards, these people, these white people, these are not black people. These are not Mexican peoples. These are not even Jews. These were your fellow white neighbors that no matter what you do that is a good thing, they will not let you off the hook for being for white people. Yeah, for being for white people. I mean, this is why you can't have any sympathy for the bastards. The Christ Insanity people and all that. Because even if they wanted to, they're too cowardly. These people are too cowardly. When I go to the county fair once a year, they have a booth for the amateur radio club. And I stop by and I always say, you know, I helped create this damn club. How come you never invite me? They won't even talk to me. So this was, you know, it reminded me, I was watching a show last night on television. A fictional show. It's about a guy's able to find a wormhole and go back in time. And he comes back from being back in time and he recruits another guy. He's bound and determined to stop the assassination of President Kennedy. And so he sends this young guy back. Well, it just happens so that they go into the deal about General Walker. Now, for you younger people that don't remember General Walker, he was the commander of USSR, which was the division I was in the Army in Europe. And now here we were in a Cold War, and at that time we saw the Soviet Union and communism as this super, super great threat, right? And he was the general command, so on the spare time, he was taking young soldiers and having lectures on the evils of communism. In other words, he was an extreme right-wing anti-communist, which at the time was supposed to be the great patriotic position to take. Well, Lee Harvey Oswald... they say, shot at him through his window and injured General Walker. And this young guy and his buddy that had were operating and trying to find out whether Lee Harvey Oswald actually was the man who did all this, they were standing across the street from the general's house, and he had two American flags upside down, which is the international distress call. And the guy, kid asked the other guy, he says, well, what's that about? He said, oh, he's just a sociopath, crazy man. See, that's the way it works. General Walker was a patriot. He might, how wrong or right he was about some things, I don't know. I know he declared to run for president against Kennedy in 64. Had a sign in front of his house. So, and then later on, to show how they'll never leave you go, trying to set you up, they arrested General Walker in a bathroom in, I believe, Dallas, said that he was approached an undercover cop in a perverse way. I never believed that because I believe they set people up all the time. Now, it's possible, of course. I'm never saying it's impossible. But I don't believe General Walker ever did that. And it was just another way of defaming him long after his military power was over. So I think you get the message on when people say, Tom, you're bitter. You're just becoming a bitter old man. You're going to end up being all by yourself in a room. And sometimes that don't look too bad. But anyhow, why? I mean, you're attacking white people. You spend almost as much time attacking white people as non-white people. In fact, I think you spend more. Well, that's because white people don't have any excuse. They should know, and they should fight for their race, and they won't. So why wouldn't I be more hateful of white people who don't know the score than I do non-whites? I'm not mad at black people for fighting for the black race. I'm not mad at them for that. I'm mad at them when they brutalize white people. But it's white people who give the blacks everything they've gotten. I mean, a few of them have gotten. I mean, you know, all these upper middle class blacks and even rich blacks could thank your lucky stars because white people gave that to them. They took it away from the white race and gave it to the black race just to keep the black race happy. I mean, even the Jews are interested in the best interests for Jews. They argue and fight and even kill each other, but still, generally, they are fighting for their, whatever their situation is, whether it's religion or culture or even some, as some say, race. They are fighting for their people. It's difficult for me to attack people who are fighting for their people. It's very easy for me to attack people who are hurting their people, white people. I mean, I hate those people with a perfect hatred. Do you understand my logic? God damn it, do you understand my logic? Remember that Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 that shot down over the Ukraine and they keep trying to pin on the Russians? Well, our She-Wolf Ace reporter is here to talk about it.
Exclusive. The shootdown of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 over Ukraine has served as a potent propaganda. Airlines Flight 17 over Ukraine has served as a potent propaganda club against Russia, but the United States government is hiding key evidence that could solve the mystery, writes Robert Perry. The curious mystery surrounding the shootdown of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 over eastern Ukraine on July 17, 2014, gets more curious and more curious as the United States government and Dutch investigators balk at giving straightforward answers to the simplest of questions even when asked by the families of the victims. Adding to the mystery, Dutch investigators have indicated that the Dutch Safety Board did not request radar information from the United States, even though Secretary of State John Kerry indicated just 3 days after the crash that the United States government possessed data that pinpointed the location of the suspected missile launch that allegedly downed the airliner, killing all 298 people on board. A Malaysia Airways Boeing 777, like the one that crashed in eastern Ukraine on July 17, 2014. Photo credit, Aero Icarus from Zurich, Switzerland. A Malaysia Airways Boeing 777 like the one that crashed in eastern Ukraine on July 17, 2014. Photo credit, Aero Icarus from Zurich, Switzerland. Although Kerry claimed that the United States government knew the location almost immediately, Dutch investigators now say they hope to identify the spot sometime in the second half of the year, meaning that something as basic as the missile launch site might remain unknown to the public more than 2 years after the tragedy. The families of the Dutch victims, including the father of a Dutch-American citizen, have been pressing for an explanation about the slow pace of the investigation and the apparent failure to obtain relevant data from the United States and other governments. I spent time with the family members in early February at the Dutch Parliament in The Hague as opposition parliamentarians, led by Christian Democrat Peter Omtzigt, unsuccessfully sought answers from the government about the absence of radar data and other basic facts. Dutch parliamentarian Peter Omtzigt. Dutch parliamentarian Peter Omtzigt. When answers have been provided to the families and the public, they are often hard to understand, as if to obfuscate what information the investigation possesses or doesn't possess. For instance, when I asked the United States State Department whether the United States government had supplied the Dutch with radar data and satellite images, I received the following response, attributable to a State Department spokesperson, "While I won't go into the details of our law enforcement cooperation in the investigation, I would note that Dutch officials said March 8 that all information asked of the United States has been shared." I wrote back thanking the spokesperson for the response, but adding, "I must say it seems unnecessarily fuzzy. Why can't you just say that the United States government has provided the radar data cited by Secretary Kerry immediately after the tragedy? Or that the United States government has provided satellite imagery before and after the shootdown? Why the indirect and imprecise phrasing?" I've spent time with the Dutch families of the victims, including the father of a Dutch citizen, and I can tell you that they are quite disturbed by what they regard as double talk and stalling. I would like to tell them that my government has provided all relevant data in a cooperative and timely fashion. But all I get is this indirect and imprecise wordsmithing. The State Department spokesperson wrote back, "I understand your questions, and also the importance of the view of these families so devastated by this tragedy. However, I am going to have to leave our comments as below. Propaganda value." This lack of transparency, of course, has a propaganda value since it leaves in place the widespread public impression that ethnic Russian rebels and Russian President Vladimir Putin were responsible for the 298 deaths, a rush to judgment that Secretary Kerry and other senior United States officials, and the Western news media, encouraged in July 2014. Once that impression took hold, there has been little interest in official Washington to clarify the mystery, especially as evidence has emerged implicating elements of the Ukrainian military. For instance, Dutch intelligence has reported, and the United States intelligence has implicitly confirmed, that the only operational Buk anti-aircraft missile systems in eastern Ukraine on July 17, 2014, were under the control of the Ukrainian military. In a Dutch report released last October, the Netherlands Military Intelligence and Security Service, MIVD, reported that the only anti-aircraft weapons in eastern Ukraine capable of bringing down MH17 at 33,000 feet belonged to the Ukrainian government. MIVD made that assessment in the context of explaining why commercial aircraft continued to fly over the eastern Ukrainian battle zone in summer 2014. MIVD said that based on state secret information, it was known that Ukraine possessed some older but powerful anti-aircraft systems, and a number of these systems were located in the eastern part of the country. The intelligence agency added that the rebels lacked that capability. Prior to the crash, the MIVD knew that, in addition to light aircraft artillery, the separatists also possessed short-range portable air defense systems, manned portable air defense systems, manned pads, and that they possibly possessed short-range vehicle-borne air defense systems. Both types of systems are considered surface-to-air missiles, SAMs. Due to their limited range, they do not constitute a danger to civil aviation at cruising altitude. One could infer a similar finding by reading a United States government assessment released by the Director of National Intelligence on July 22, 2014, 5 days after the crash, seeking to cast suspicion on the ethnic Russian rebels and Putin by noting military equipment that Moscow had provided the rebels. But most tellingly, the list did not include Buk anti-aircraft missiles. In other words, in the context of trying to blame the rebels and Putin, the United States intelligence could not put an operational Buk system in the rebels' hands. So, perhaps the most logical suspicion would be that the Ukrainian military, then engaged in an offensive in the east and fearing a possible Russian invasion, moved its Buk missile systems up to the front, and an undisciplined crew fired a missile at a suspected Russian aircraft, bringing down MH-17 by accident. That was essentially what I was told by a source who had been briefed by the United States intelligence analysts in July and August 2014. See, for instance, ConsortiumNews.com's Flight 17 shoot-down scenario shifts and the danger of an MH-17 cold case. But Ukraine is a principal participant in the Dutch-led Joint Investigative Team, JIT, which has been probing the MH-17 case, and thus the investigation suffers from a possible conflict of interest, since Ukraine would prefer that the world's public perception of the MH-17 case continue to blame Putin. Under the JIT's terms, any of the five key participants, the Netherlands, Ukraine, Australia, Belgium, and Malaysia, can block release of information. The interest in keeping Putin on the propaganda defensive is shared by the Obama administration, which used the furor over the MH17 deaths to spur the European Union into imposing economic sanctions on Russia. In contrast, clearing the Russians and blaming the Ukrainians would destroy a carefully constructed propaganda narrative which has stuck black hats on Putin and the ethnic Russian rebels and white hats on the U.S.-backed government of Ukraine, which seized power after a putsch that overthrew elected pro-Russian President Viktor Yanukovych on February 22, 2014. Accusations against Russia have also been fanned by propaganda outlets, such as the British-based Bellingcat site, which has collaborated with Western mainstream media to continue pointing the finger of blame at Moscow and Putin as the Dutch investigators drag their heels and refuse to divulge any information that would clarify the case. Letter to the families. Perhaps the most detailed, although still hazy, status report on the investigation came in a recent letter from JIT Chief Prosecutor Fred Westerbeek to the Dutch family members. The letter acknowledged that the investigators lacked primary raw radar images which could have revealed a missile or a military aircraft in the vicinity of MH17. Ukrainian authorities said all their primary radar facilities were shut down for maintenance and only secondary radar, which would show commercial aircraft, was available. Russian officials have said their radar data suggests that a Ukrainian warplane might have fired on MH-17 with an air-to-air missile, a possibility that is difficult to rule out without examining primary radar, which has so far not been available. Primary radar data also might have picked up a ground-fired missile, Westerbeek wrote. Raw primary radar data could provide information on the rocket trajectory, Westerbeek's letter said. The JIT does not have that information yet. JIT has questioned a member of the Ukrainian air traffic control and a Ukrainian radar specialist. They explained why no primary radar images were saved in Ukraine. Westerbeek said investigators are also asking Russia about its data. Westerbeek added that the JIT had no video or film of the launch or the trajectory of the rocket. Nor, he said, do the investigators have satellite photos of the rocket launch. The clouds on the part of the day of the downing of MH17 prevented usable pictures of the launch site from being available, he wrote. There are pictures from just before and just after July 17, and they are an asset in the investigation. According to intelligence sources, the satellite photos show several Ukrainian military Buk missile systems in the area. Secretary of State John Kerry denounces Russia's RT network as a propaganda bullhorn during remarks on April 24, 2014. Secretary of State John Kerry denounces Russia's RT network as a propaganda bullhorn during remarks on April 24, 2014. Why the investigation's data is so uncertain has become a secondary mystery in the MH17 whodunit. During an appearance on NBC's Meet the Press on July 20, 2014, 3 days after the crash, Secretary Kerry declared, "We picked up the imagery of this launch. We know the trajectory. We know where it came from. We know the timing. And it was exactly at the time that this aircraft disappeared from the radar. But this, the United States data has never been made public." In the letter, Westerbeek wrote, "The American authorities have data that come from their own secret services, which could provide information on the trajectory of the rocket. This information was shared in secret with the Dutch MIVD." Westerbeek added that the information may be made available as proof in a criminal case as an ambspericht or official statement. Yet, despite the United States data, Westerbeek said the location of the launch site remains uncertain. Last October, the Dutch Safety Board placed the likely firing location within a 320 square kilometer area that covered territory both under government and rebel control. By contrast, Almazanti, the Russian arms manufacturer of the Buk systems, conducted its own experiments to determine the likely firing location and placed it in a much smaller area near the village of Zaroshchenskoy, about 20 kilometers west of the Dutch Safety Board's zone and in an area under Ukrainian government control. Westerbeek wrote, "Raw primary radar data and the American secret information are only two sources of information for the determination of the launch site. There is more. JIT collects evidence on the basis of telephone taps, locations of telephones, pictures, witness statements and technical calculations of the trajectory of the rocket. The calculations are made by the National Air and Space Laboratory on the basis of the location of MH17, the damage pattern on the wreckage and the special characteristics of the rockets. JIT does extra research on top of the Dutch Safety Board research. On the basis of these sources, JIT gets ever more clarity on the exact launch site. In the second half of the year we expect exact results." Quinn Chansman, a dual U.S. Dutch citizen killed aboard Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 on July 17, 2014. Meanwhile, that the United States government continues to stonewall a request from Thomas J. Shanzman, the father of Quinn Shanzman, the only American citizen to die aboard MH17, to Secretary Kerry to release the United States data that Kerry has publicly cited. Quinn Shanzman, who had dual U.S. Dutch citizenship, boarded MH17 along with 297 other people for a flight from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur on July 17, 2014. The 19-year-old was planning to join his family for a vacation in Malaysia. In a letter to Kerry dated January 5, 2016, Thomas J. Shanzman noted Kerry's remarks at a press conference on August 12, 2014, when the Secretary of State said about the Buk anti-aircraft missile suspected of downing the plane, "We saw the takeoff. We saw the trajectory. We saw the hit. We saw this aeroplane disappear from the radar screens. So there is really no mystery about where it came from and where these weapons have come from." Although the United States consular officials in the Netherlands indicated that Kerry would respond personally to the request, Shanzman told me this week that he had not yet received a reply from Kerry.
Well, thank you, She-Wolf, for that report. Very interesting. We'll be posting this on our website, in case you want to refer other people to it. You know, it's interesting how the Jews in Israel keep chomping away at Palestinian land. I mean, you know, the Palestinians don't have hardly anything, you know, but the Israelis keep trying to chew it up and get a little bit more, you know. Listen to this from our reporter, She-Wolf.
On Tuesday, Israel's Army Radio reported, based largely on a Peace Now report, that the Israeli government had seized 580 acres, less than 1 square mile, of land in Judea near the Dead Sea and Jericho. The coordinated publicity by Israel's most left-wing radio station, the IDF's own, and the most dedicated enemy of Jewish life in Judea and Samaria, Peace Now, quickly generated the expected results. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said Israel must reverse its confiscation of land, because it is an impediment to the two-state solution. And UN spokesman Stephen Dujarric added that such actions appear to point toward an increase in settlement activities and demonstrate that Israel is continuing to push forward in the consolidation of its control of the West Bank, and settlements are illegal under international law, and the Secretary General urges the government of Israel to halt and reverse such actions in the interest of a just and comprehensive peace and a just final status agreement. Settlements are illegal under the Geneva Convention when the land in question was taken from a sovereign owner. But since the Jordanian crown's rule over Judea and Samaria was not recognized internationally, with the exception of the UK, the land Israel took in 1967 was no man's land, available for settling. This or that Israeli government may wish to use this land as part of a peace negotiation with an enemy entity, and even to evacuate whole settlements, but not because said settlements are illegal by international law. They aren't. As of 1979, Israel has been settling in Judea and Samaria on state land. The term was coined by then-Attorney General Aharon Barak, later Israel's most renowned Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who certainly could not be suspected of having right-wing aspirations. Barak wrote in 1979, "The presupposition in determining ownership of the land is that every land is state-owned, unless it was purchased by someone else. Therefore, unused land with no relevant documentation of ownership should be presumed to be state land." Despite this clear opinion of the AG, the Begin government decided that in order to preserve the rights of potential Arab owners, it would institute two additional steps before a land is declared available for acquisition, a review process, followed by a declaration of the pending acquisition. Until the Oslo Agreement, the area in question would have been acquired by this method without any problem. What changed since Oslo was the fact that now Judea and Samaria are divided into three separate areas, two of which, areas A and B, are exclusively for Arab land acquisition, and one, area C, is under Israeli control. As long as the Oslo agreements are in force, land acquisition in Area C is legal, regardless of whether or not it contributes to the two-state solution. You can say they do not promote the two-state idea, but you can't say they are illegal. In fact, the land in question has been in Jewish possession since the mid-1990s, being used for the fields of Moshav Vird Yeriko, which settled nearby in 1980. In effect, those 580 acres had been in a state of review for all these years, and in all this time no Arab claimant has been found, and we trust that had there been such a claimant, peace now would have paid for his appeal in Israel's Supreme Court. The same distinction between what promotes the two-state solution and what is illegal was the background to Tuesday's State Department press conference. State Department spokesman John Kirby was asked about the confiscation, and answered, "We're concerned about this reported expropriation of 580 acres in the West Bank estate land, which is a significant increase over the prior announcement. This decision is, in our view, the latest step in what appears to be an ongoing process of land expropriations, settlement expansions, and legalizations of outposts that is fundamentally undermining the prospects for a two-state solution." Kirby continued, "As we have said before, we strongly oppose any steps that accelerate settlement expansion, which raise serious questions about Israel's long-term intentions. And as we've repeatedly made clear, we continue to look to both sides to demonstrate with actions and policies a genuine commitment to a two-state solution. Actions such as these do just the opposite." The Arab reporter who brought up the issue followed with the question, "Saeb Erekat, the chief Palestinian negotiator, said that they are going to the UN Security Council with this, and they hope to have the support of the international community. If this comes up in the face of Israel not being deterred on these land confiscations, will you support the Palestinian effort at the United Nations if this comes up at the UN?" Kirby's response to that one was noncommittal, but at this point Israel has no assurances that, should a PA complaint against Israeli land seizures be submitted to the UN Security Council, the Obama administration would necessarily veto an anti-Israel resolution. Ignorance of the law, innocent or willful, marks much of the popular criticism of Israel's policy in Judea and Samaria, both inside and outside the Jewish state. And as was once noted by Herr Joseph Goebbels, lies that are repeated often enough become truths. About the author, JNI.media provides editors and publishers with high-quality Jewish-focused content for their publications.
So this was just more Jewish propaganda of how they take over and they can't find the owners, the Arab owners. They never could find them. Well, it's the pot calling the pan black to talk about Joseph Goebbels, because Israeli Jews, or Jews period, use that all the time. Tell a lie often enough and everybody believes it. Almost everything they do is that way. The whole Bible is almost all that way. If you tell a story enough times, that makes it true, no matter whether it's true or not.
The triple homicide of a Puerto Rican man and a Hmong couple in Milwaukee has elements of a hate crime, but may be difficult to prosecute as such and would be largely symbolic as the suspect already faces charges that carry a life sentence. Dan J. Pop, 39, is charged with first-degree intentional homicide in the fatal shooting of his neighbors Jesus Armanso Perez, 40, Faya Vu, 36, and Mike Vu, 32. If convicted, each of those charges carries a mandatory penalty of life in prison. Pop also faces a charge of attempted first-degree intentional homicide for firing toward Manso Perez's 18-year-old son. Pop has not been charged with a hate crime, and Milwaukee County prosecutors are still evaluating the evidence to determine whether any additional charges or enhancers are appropriate, Chief Deputy District Attorney Kent Lovern said. It is important to note that the hate crime penalty enhancer would add only 5 years of potential imprisonment to each of the existing charges, including the ones that carry life sentences, Lovern said. Witnesses told police Pop questioned Manso Perez and his son about their background at their apartment building in the 3300 block of S92nd ST. When they said they were from Puerto Rico, Pop replied, "Oh, that's why you don't speak English," the son told police. A short time later, Pop pointed the gun at Manso Perez saying, "You guys got to go," and pulled the trigger, according to the criminal complaint. Mark Potok, senior fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center, said the incident certainly contains elements that suggest a hate crime, but it's rather scant. "We're about talking two sentences of conversation," Potok said. It also seems very possible that prosecutors will decide they simply don't have the evidence to proceed. Prosecutors say after killing Manso Perez, Pop went to the apartment of Hmong couple Faya and Mai Vu. He fatally shot them after pulling them out of a bedroom in front of their four children and another relative, authorities have alleged. The criminal complaint does not mention Pop, who is white, making any racist statements to the family. Potok acknowledged that a hate crime enhancement to a homicide charge usually does not make much difference in the penalty, but said it can fulfill a symbolic role. "I think that victims and the communities of victims very much want to see a hate crime charges brought when there is a hate element in the crime, and that seems to be universal," he said. Pop's attorney, Christopher Hartley, has raised the question of his mental competency, and a judge has ordered a mental evaluation, which is due back next month. Although most people with diagnosed mental illnesses are not violent, Pop's history did not come as a surprise to Potok. A very large number of major hate crimes and terrorist attacks involve at least some element of mental illness, but it's still a mix, he said. The triple homicide of a Puerto Rican man and a Hmong couple in Milwaukee has elements of a hate crime, but may be difficult to prosecute as such and would be largely symbolic as the suspect already faces charges that carry a life sentence. Dan J. Pop, 39, is charged with first-degree intentional homicide in the fatal shooting of his neighbors Jesus Armanso Perez, 40, Faya Vu, 36, and Mike Vu, 32. If convicted, each of those charges carries a mandatory penalty of life in prison. Pop also faces a charge of attempted first-degree intentional homicide for firing toward Manso Perez's 18-year-old son. Pop has not been charged with a hate crime, and Milwaukee County prosecutors are still evaluating the evidence to determine whether any additional charges or enhancers are appropriate, Chief Deputy District Attorney Kent Lovern said. It is important to note that the hate crime penalty enhancer would add only 5 years of potential imprisonment to each of the existing charges,
If ever the worm turns in this country, I want you to remember this, that all of the politicians, all the people in power, all the lawmakers that have installed this type of thing and brought all of these unassimilable people into the country must be prosecuted. At some point, they must be tracked down, just like the Jews tracked down the National Socialists and try them. That must be the case. Remember, and in fact, maybe better keep a clipping file of all this, but it won't be too hard. At some point, when the worm turns to go after these people, pursue them as complicity in these murders. Yeah, they're just as much involved as the perpetrator over a long period of time. If these people were not brought into this country, into a situation where they're not acceptable, this would not happen.
Last year, 23 reported transgender women were murdered. And, though the majority of those crimes have gone unsolved, we're one step closer to justice for the youngest victim, Mercedes Williamson, who was bludgeoned to death with a hammer at only 17. In early June 2015, Mercedes's alleged assailant, 28-year-old Josh Vallum, who was her boyfriend, told his father that he had killed someone and buried that person in the field behind his dad's Alabama home. The next day, authorities dug up a partially decomposed body and arrested Josh. Due to an affidavit filed in the court this past week, the Sun-Herald discovered the reported member of the Latin Kings Street Gang has confessed to police that he committed the crime. Josh's trial is set for July 18 and the district attorney's office is seeking a DNA sample to compare to the blood stains found in his car. Josh, who has been in police custody since early June, also requested a reduction in his $1 million bond, stating, "I have a job waiting on me upon my release and request a bond of a reasonable amount so that I be allowed to better prepare myself for trial, sentencing, and incarceration, but he's not likely to get it." Admitting to a murder, absent some claim of self-defense, automatically makes the defendant potentially dangerous to the community. Jennifer Rogers, a former federal prosecutor and the executive director at the Center for the Advancement of Public Integrity at Columbia Law School, told Broadly. And his confession will also hopefully help the prosecution's case against Josh, who, despite the confession, pleaded not guilty, according to the Sun-Herald. Short of a video of a defendant actually committing a crime, there is nothing more powerful than hearing that the defendant, in his own words, admitted a crime, Rogers said. The defense will have to undermine the confession somehow at trial, and will likely spend a great deal of its time working on this aspect of the case. But there remains one big question: will the case be investigated as a hate crime? Though, according to the advocate, Josh knew that Mercedes, an aspiring cosmetologist, was a transgender woman before he killed her, the motive for the crime is still unknown. According to Rogers, who said she isn't familiar enough with this specific case to know whether or not it qualifies, the federal hate crimes law explicitly includes gender identity as one of its categories, so there could be a way to charge the crime federally if the state murder prosecution is unsuccessful for some reason. If Mercedes's murder is charged as a hate crime, it will be a unique case, as most of the transgender murders last year were not classified in that way, despite the fact that there seems to be a clear epidemic. Gender theorist Judith Butler told Broadly last year that men often kill transgender women as a result of feeling threatened. Trans women have relinquished masculinity, and that is very threatening to a man who wants to see his power as an intrinsic feature of who he is, she said. Though the specific details surrounding Josh and Mercedes's relationship are not well known, the classification of her brutal murder as a hate crime and if Josh felt he could get away with his actions because of her gender identity, are crucial for the transgender community. Every time one trans person is killed, the message goes out to every trans person, "You are not safe, this dead body could be yours," Butler said. So when the crime is not named as a hate crime, or when the crime is dismissed because the murderer was somehow prompted, the police are sending the same message as the murderer. Officials now have the opportunity with Josh's confession to get to the bottom of why Mercedes was murdered and offer real justice not only for her death, but also for all the other transgender women who are victims of violent crimes. Let's hope they investigate this incident properly.
Well, I guess I didn't hear it right, but I thought they said a guy from the Latin Kings, who's most likely non-white, killed the woman, or killed whatever. But anyhow, this is just like the one before. This, when you keep continually promoting an oddball racial situation into a heterosexual situation, you're going to have these problems. And it's going to keep happening. And again, at some point, I believe the people who are heavily promoting this type of activity are complicit in these murders, and they should be arrested and tried. I believe that, because they know, the professional transgender community know what this is causing, and it's not going to go away. So if it's not going to go away and it's being caused by this transgender community, well, then they are complicit in the murders of their own friends. That's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow on Freya's Day. And thank you, She-Wolf, for helping me out with the show.
Your generals are bandits, lord on the Catholic King of France. You employ any mercy you can get to lord on the Catholic King of Spain. And the Pope plays politics, as by 100 other princes, kings, bishops,
all for their own rotten purposes.
All sides are rotten, except for people like you, religious fanatics, who incite murder for the sake of a God.